Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. So at this point in the prehistory season of Tides of History, it should be clear that the Eurasian Steppe is central to understanding how and why the world has taken on its present shape over the past 5,000-ish years. The grasslands at the core of Eurasia have served as a highway for people, languages, ideas, and technologies, facilitating their spread everywhere from the Atlantic to the Sea of Japan. To help us better understand the steppe's place in history, especially the Bronze Age, we've got a fantastic guest with us here today. His work focuses on the pastoral nomads of Central and Eastern Eurasia during that period and uses a whole bunch of innovative, cutting-edge approaches to the topic. He's a professor of archaeology in the Department of Anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis, national visiting professor at Northwest University Xi'an, China, and a National Geographic explorer. Along with Nicole Boivin, he edited the recent book Globalization in Prehistory. Prior to that, with Robert Spengler, he edited Mobility and Ancient Society in Asia and the Americas. He's currently writing a book on ancient Inner Asia and has also co-authored and authored a truly intimidating number of articles. Professor Michael Fricchetti, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So what initially drew your interest to Central Asia, to pastoralism, and to the Bronze Age?
Yeah, I think in part I can probably thank Mikhail Gorbachev for that. I was a child of the 80s and the early 90s. So if you had done this interview in 1990, you know, my hair would have been a bit longer and I probably would have been wearing a flannel. And, you know, so I'm right in that sweet spot of, you know, 1990, kind of having my own mind come to fruition in terms of like, wow, there's this whole world out there that nobody knows about and it's behind the Iron Curtain. Sort of ironic given where we are politically today with what's going on in Russia, et cetera. But nevertheless, coming to college then in 93 or whatever it was, the world was just like, there was just so much attention on what was behind the former Iron Curtain and all that kind of thing that really just piqued my interest. And I had a great opportunity to work along the Russian border as an undergraduate student in Finland, actually. We were driving pontoon boats up the Kuusamo River looking for prehistoric archaeology in the high Arctic, which is just borders along the easternmost frontiers of Russia. And we were interacting with all these Russian border guards. And I was thinking to myself, like, wow, I need to learn Russian. Russian is so cool. And so, you know, that whole set of experiences kind of triggered me to start looking at the area. And because it was 1996, 1997, by the time I got to starting my PhD, there were so few Americans who had really stepped foot in those regions of the world. I mean, obviously centuries before, and there were certain people who were really pioneers, my former advisors and things, but you know, it was a really small number. And so the opportunity to work in Central Asia in the late 90s was still super novel.
And so if that's what drew you to it in the first place, what has kept your interest there? Because presumably you've been working on this for a long time, like your interest might wander elsewhere, but it really seems like you've stayed focused on Central Asia. Like, what has kept your interest there?
I think part of the issue is that, for me at least, was that archaeology is a funny discipline, right? We always hear the anecdotes about the Indiana Jones model or, you know, whatever, those crazy, like, really inappropriate models of archaeology that don't have anything to do with archaeology. But nevertheless, they do drum up a fantasy of traveling and seeing the world and doing exploration and things. Any archaeologist who tells you that they don't at least somewhat think about that is lying to you. Not in terms of the Indiana Jones specifically, but just the notion that, like, it draws a certain kind of, like, adventure junkie in most cases. It also draws people who are super focused academics, people who really get into the literature and really dig in deep. And if you're one or the other, archaeology isn't for you. But if you're a little bit of both, it's a great discipline. And I think that for me, it started off perhaps, you know, as a younger person with pretty naive sense of what the world was about, maybe more of the former, like, wow, I'm going to get to go to these parts of the world where, you know, no one else has ever stepped and all the other drama. But then as soon as you get there, you realize that the questions that people are asking and that they have asked are extremely central to what we need to know about the world. So everything from the clothes we wear to the food we eat to the way, you know, the metals we use, you know, all the things, every contour of history seems to have an arm that reaches into this region. And yet, with the exception of the Soviets, who had done decades of research in their own framework, their own epistemology, the Western world had really, and I think in still in many cases still does, have really overstated misconceptions about what actually Central Asia is about. I certainly started with many of those misconceptions, and it was only through literally now decades of kind of like diving into it and really seeing it for what it is that you begin to challenge them. And in a sense, it's never over, right? That's what keeps you going, is that you're like, you know, you do 10 years of work and you think you've got an answer, and all of a sudden a new discovery comes out and you're like, yeah, I've got to bend the first 10 years and go back to the beginning. And so it is an area of such vast proportions that you can really learn a lot of, even in your own, you know, which is what science is supposed to be about.
So I have two things I want to follow up on there. First is that in my experience, archaeologists are absolutely the most fun academics, at least in the history adjacent disciplines with which I'm familiar. I've never had more fun than I've had with archaeologists. So that's number one. But number two, I want to follow up on something you said about the epistemology of Soviet archaeology, because it's been super disorienting for me as I've been trying to work through the last 40-ish years of work on like the Bactria Margiana archaeological complex and excavations on the Andronovo culture pioneered by Soviet archaeologists, and like understanding the very different way of looking at the material and like things that they take as givens. Like there's like a really bald-faced statement in something that I was just reading on Indo-Iranians that is like, well, that language and culture absolutely must go together. And I'm like, okay, all right, I guess if you say so. And it was just super disorienting that like a totally different archaeological tradition.
Yeah, I address some of these things in some of my work. If you dig into sort of some of the publications on migration, or even my first book, Pastoralist Landscapes, that book deals in part with this kind of problem of, you know, the abrupt meeting of different epistemological frameworks. But in a nutshell, you know, the key point is that Russian archaeology grew out of a purely Soviet tradition for the majority of it. There was a collectionary phase, like many in the 19th century under the Tsar, but archaeology as a discipline was established by Lenin. And Lenin was a huge, you know, reader of Marx, but also a modifier of Marx. So he takes Marxism, which has its own sort of historical evolutionary track, where societies fit in sort of a historical framework, and has to compensate for the fact that now, as the Soviet Union is growing, they're meeting populations from Kamchatka all the way to Lithuania or whatever that have really different forms of production mode. And that's really where Marx is, how you make your money, how you make your living. And so for Marxism and this Soviet model, how you do things at the economic level shaped who you were as a society. And who you are as a society is then a reflection of your ideology, your language, what they called your ethnos. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like ethnicity, but not quite. They're slightly different concepts. So ethnos is like a full package cultural bundle. So your economy, your language, your way of life, your institutions, all these things are bundled in this concept of ethnos. And it's not totally unflexible. It's just that that's how you expect to see the world. And so for contemporary societies, there's a huge disciplinary approach to this is how societies are bundled. Like, you know, nomads of Siberia operate like this, and these people operate like that. And then Marxism will do this wonderful thing of bringing everybody towards the communist ideal. You know, that's like the most inadequate sort of summary of this extremely complex epistemology. But it was overriding for all the scholars. And so as they were getting into archaeology then, it was sort of like they had to create an ethnos around material culture, which was kind of easy because you had cups and sticks and bones and stones and said, okay, well, these things all fit around a mode of production, which is pastoralism. It fits around a mode of production, which is farming villagers. It fits around a mode of production, which is, you know, medieval client relationships. So fine, those were like modes, and those modes meant something in terms of history. Therefore, archaeology, whether it's the BMAC or Andronovo or any other culture group, has a slightly different flair to it than the culture history that the West was experiencing at the same time, which was to say, you know, there was culture historians in Germany, culture historians in Europe, and ultimately even adopted by North American scholars. That culture history, which was kind of done away with by the 1950s and 60s as people became to embrace scientific archaeology, it stayed as the major sort of framing reference for Soviet archaeology up until the late 80s. So while the, you know, Western traditions, European and American traditions, went through this sort of scientific revolution and then a postmodern revolution on top of that, sort of criticizing the scientific approaches, the Soviets kind of stayed put with this culture historical ethnos model that wrote, and it was all based on materiality. So your article, if you're writing an article for a Soviet journal, all you had to do was start with the material stuff and you basically put down all of the pots and pans and all the things that you found, right? All the materials, the metals and whatever it might be. And you can categorize all that in very sort of stark terms. And then you have it. You just make the argument according to the Marxist model. You say, okay, these societies fit into the historical model as such. Here's the material we found. And that apparently shows that, and done. Thank you. And you move on. Doesn't get you in trouble politically. You're in the ideological realm and you've published your material and you've done your job and you get your paycheck. I mean, it was sort of in a very crass way of describing it. That's essentially how a lot of it played out. What it really left the Soviet scholars doing then is producing extremely rich material volumes. Like you can go to material articles in the Soviet tradition and it's just like beautifully done assemblages of material. Which were then turned into Andronovo culture or some subset thereof or whatever. For the steppe, that was the main one, right? And, you know, someone like Elena Kuzmina, one of the major pioneers in steppe archaeology, you know, I sat and had tea with her in her house in Moscow before she passed away, years before she passed away, when I was still a graduate student. It's funny because, you know, I sat with her and I, at that time, was like rethinking all of the data. And I'm sitting there with Elena Kuzmina, who's like, decades into her career, you know, she's already an elderly stateswoman in this case. And I'm sitting there and perhaps in a slightly like, you know, hubristic fashion, I was like, well, you know, I'm going to argue against some of the things that you've written. And I told, she's like, oh, well, what would that be? And I told her, she says, no, that's not, I agree with you. And I'm like, really? Because the things you wrote sounded completely different. And she kind of like winks and nods. And she's like, yeah, well, you know, we all know what we know. And these are two different things, right? In some cases. And it made me really sort of have an incredibly different appreciation for my Russian colleagues, especially the ones who were raised and who published throughout the Soviet era. Because what it meant is that a lot of their conversations and understandings about the world were not always reflected in what they wrote. And then when they finally got to a point of status, they could then write what they wanted. And, you know, again, could write and did write are different things. Like there's a lot of flexibility in terms of what limitations there were. It's like you could push the boundaries, and you might be rewarded or you might be not rewarded. And so that risk formula is something that, you know, obviously I don't know for each individual, but it means that reading Soviet literature, you really have to kind of core into it and think differently about what their mission was. But nevertheless, they provided us with volumes and volumes and volumes of archaeological data. And so it's sort of like a starting point that by the 1990s and mid-1990s, as long as you can read Russian, you could essentially re-surmise an incredibly wealthy amount of data that was systematized and organized, albeit just with slightly different technology and under a different kind of theoretical framework.
It's really fascinating that you mentioned just the sheer volume of work that was done, because it seems like that's the basis for the entire ancient DNA revolution is excavations that were done during the Soviet period and immediately after that have created this incredibly rich body of human remains that can now be sampled to give us an exceptionally fine-grained understanding of the, you know, genetic population changes in the steppe. Same deal with now with material remains, going back and doing lipid analyses and things like that on stuff that was pulled out of the ground in these excavations decades ago. And so even if the framework through which it was published and interpreted is superseded or was a very specific product of its times, the actual work that was done, incredibly high quality, and is going to be paying dividends for decades, centuries down the road.
Yeah. And of course, that introduces a couple different issues, right? I mean, I've as you know, I've been involved in the genetics projects in part because of, you know, more in-depth knowledge of a lot of these partners that we work with and who they are and what they've done and what the history of some of these projects are. And the reality is if you were to take any archival data set, whether it be in the former Soviet Union or anywhere else, you're always going to run into similar issues. But the biggest issues, of course, outside of ethics, which we can talk about in a second, from a strictly scientific kind of data-oriented perspective, you've got issues of the material preservation, which is variable across various regions of the former Soviet Union. Best wishing, you know, the people who are doing it are doing the best they can. But in some cases, they just, you know, technologically, you could find parts of the Soviet Union that just didn't have the capacity. So bones weren't kept in air-conditioned spaces or, you know, cross-contaminated spaces and these kinds of things. So there's that realm of stuff that's out there that it just sort of needs to be considered. It's a vast territory and a vastly different sort of set of things from Moscow to, you know, wherever. So there's that portion of it. But the bigger issues are, I think, chronology is probably the biggest. And this is one of the ones that's really, for my career, it was one of the most challenging and also, in a sense, like revolutionary. By the late 1990s, a lot of scholars were just simply not fully convinced that radiocarbon dating was the way to go. And it wasn't that they were dumb. This isn't because they were, you know, Luddites or something. It was because their entire framework for understanding all of that had been done through the Soviet Union was based on a relative chronological system. So it wasn't based on an absolute chronology. And so foreigners, you know, Americans, foreigners, Europeans, whatever, were coming in and saying, well, yeah, but I can't publish a relative chronology. Let's just do some radiocarbon dates. And that led to a bunch of big problems. Dates don't always match up. The amount of matchup that does exist is astounding to me. Like, I'm always baffled by how scholars who didn't have access to radiocarbon were so good at getting the chronology pretty close to right. So this is actually not me saying, oh, they were dumb and didn't know what they were doing. It's the opposite. Like, Soviet scholars were astoundingly good at getting it pretty darn close, given relative chronologies of, like, you know, things that they knew about in the textual history and then backing it up through stratigraphy and other sort of methods. But the reality is that without direct methods, you can't get that exact date. And more importantly, during phases when there's less data, it gets fuzzy. So there's periods of prehistory where the ceramics, the stone tools, and the other items could be Neolithic, they could be early Bronze Age, they could be anything. Right? So categorizing some of that material meant that things were sometimes in the wrong spot. And so these bones, which of course don't come with a date tag on them, when we're redating a lot of them, we're finding that, oh, this sample, which was categorized as such, turns out to be a different time period. And that ultimately has led to a lot of innovation in terms of how we understand the total landscape, specifically in the early periods like the early Bronze Age. So that was like the first 10 years of my career, was just like throwing enormous amounts of money into dating human remains, but more importantly, just archaeological sites, like actual carbon remains and that kind of thing, just to sort of lock in chronological sequences to say these sites are much earlier than we actually would have expected them to be, according to the old chronologies.
Well, I think it's really easy to forget now, given how far radiocarbon dating has come in the last 25 or 30 years, how imprecise it was for a long period of time, and how many times you would get a date and you would build a whole new chronology based around this one radiocarbon date, and then it would turn out that the date was wrong. And so that when you're not accounting for old wood effects or all sorts of things that can affect a radiocarbon date, or just simply you, like, a sample has mislabeled in terms of the stratigraphy of a site was taken from, all sorts of stuff. It's only now when you're taking like dozens and dozens of samples from a given site, and you can come up with these incredibly fine-grained probabilistic models of chronology, that you're in a different realm with it. And I mean, like, so I've been doing a bunch of work on Japan recently, and radiocarbon dating is a fairly recent thing there. Now, I mean, it's all, you see Bayesian radiocarbon chronologies, but like up until 20 years ago, there was a ton of resistance to doing lots of radiocarbon dating there. And again, because they had incredibly fine-grained pottery and relative chronologies based on that.
Exactly. And so that's where I was 20 years ago, right? So I was publishing radiocarbon dates for some of my early sites. And my local colleagues were like, oh, kind of tapping me on the head and saying, oh, that's cute. Like, you're changing the chronology by 1,000 years or 2,000. Oh, that's not going to be real. And it didn't happen until, you know, I was like, no, I put 65 radiocarbon dates out there. Like, these are all looking like this. You know, it's like, okay, now we get it. And of course, 20 years later, it seems like, you know, everyone's kind of on board. And we've been able to correct some of the overstatements that radiocarbon did. As you said, you know, there's been some pushback and using really advanced methods for, like, you know, reservoir effect or old wood and whatever, we can actually find out, okay, when are they true? When are they not true? And what is our real focal number? And you know, that's been a real set of progress. But with human remains, it's been a huge thing because, of course, you're talking now about 10 individuals or one individual representing, in some cases, an entire millennium's worth of genealogy. So it's like, you know, it becomes really critical to have direct dates. That's the one issue with that.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
The other issue, and I think is even more dangerous in some way, let's say more circular or however you want to put it, are these cultural categories themselves, which, you know, we talked about already. Mm-hmm. So I've been a huge proponent of like scrapping them, which is hugely like heretical to the world. Like nobody wants to get rid of the Andronovo culture, except for me, basically. There are truths to the similarities that we see in some of these societies. And some of it is borne out even in a broad sense of genetics. But the genetics picture now, I was lucky to be sort of part from the get-go of that really big study that was published in 2019 in Science. We talked to a lot of people. Everybody, you know, was involved from an ethical perspective.
Absolutely seminal paper. I've come back to it again and again and again in the work that I've been doing. This is for the listeners. I've mentioned this in episodes on Central Asia and episodes on South Asia. This is like the fundamental work on the genetic of the Bronze and Iron Age in this region.
Yeah. And, you know, working with Vagish Narasimhan was awesome. And he's the lead author on it. And he should get so much of the credit, especially for the modeling and him and Nick Patterson and David Reich and Ron Panhasi and the whole team. Anyway, the point of this is all to simply say that study, because we did sample in an archaeological fashion. Like we didn't just go in there and say, give us the samples you've got. Right? We talked to individuals with questions in mind. And we said, what are the questions that you have? How would this help? Like it took 3 years to get that paper sampled and organized because I went out and talked and I was there at the sites looking at the samples and, you know, figuring out what we were going to take and what we weren't going to take and making sure we weren't oversampling or redundantly sampling or whatever the case may be. And what became clear from the data as it came out was that what we call the Andronovo, you could parse up the Andronovo into any different set of different communities, depending on where in the PCA, the plot you want to put them. We decided on the East and West, but it doesn't quite parse out that way. If you really know the data, know the chronologies, it doesn't really work out that way. It turns out that there's a group of genetically similar people who define themselves very differently. And in every one of these groups, you have a vast number, apparently, of outliers who are completely genetically different. So, you know, if you take these major areas of the steppe, like, you know, Sintashta culture or whatever you want to call it, right? These large scale towns, basically, in the Southern Urals, you know, yeah, okay, they have a signature that's dominant, sort of the general genetic corpus, if you will. But then there's like, we have dozens of outliers from all the way from down in the south, from the BMAC. You've got people coming from all corners living amongst those populations. And so you wonder to what degree are people actually individually moving vast distances. That problem of like, if you have a bone sample and you call it something already, then you're putting it into a box before you've even let it tell its own story. And this is something that's coming out more and more as we look at data sets that are breaking the rules of the cultural groupings. So, you know, the PCA doesn't just all fit out perfectly. Like sites I've excavated don't fit pure strictly within the Andronovo PCA. They're quite fringy. And that's because, of course, they're admixed with southern populations and northern populations. And so they're in a different lineup. And, you know, that is not a cultural grouping. That's a geographic space. And so, you know, again, I tried to approach the entirety of the Bronze Age and steppe archaeology totally, just by sort of, in a sense, like, earmuffs about when I think about culture groupings, with the expectation that maybe we can think differently about how these communities are identifying maybe themselves. And this is really what's at the core of it, is that I don't care if people say Andronovo culture is like shorthand for talking about the steppe. I mean, that's fine. Andronovo culture, for those of you who are listening, I know we're getting into the deep depths here. This is sort of a general term used to describe Bronze Age people of the steppe. And it's useful for that regard, but kind of that's where it ends, right? We have so much more information now, and we can say that these different communities are doing different kinds of things. And there's a lot of diversity and a lot of choice making out there. And that's, I think, a slightly more interesting question. And I would argue that most of our colleagues agree with that, even if they maintain the nomenclature.
I mean, this really gets at the meat of what I wanted to talk to you about today, is that given all of these new methods and tools that we have for understanding the past, for looking at individuals at a fine grain level with isotope analysis, ancient DNA, you know, different ways of looking at sites. We can have a lot more different kinds of information than was possible if you're just purely looking at material things that are coming out of the ground. to what extent then should we be looking at kind of different ways of categorizing and understanding that? So networks, mobility, these are much different kinds of heuristics for thinking through the material than archaeological cultures. When archaeological cultures make sense, if what you have is a list of pottery, but if what you have is a mass of isotope data and population histories, and then you can correlate that with archaeological material, you end up with a much different kind of way of grouping people together and understanding how they relate to one another.
You've just struck upon exactly where we are, my group is right now. I mean, mm-hmm. we have really great access, and we now have the ability to look at not just, you know, networks are kind of thrown around as this kind of like thing that does something, right? But when you get into the guts of a network, it's really about how people participate with one another,
yep.
which is now all of a sudden a theoretical problem. So for my team, over the last even 5 or 6 years, we've been writing a lot about these modes of participation. Like, how do you, as a person living in a house in this location, go across a valley and arrive in another place and participate? And by that, I mean either 1, not get killed, 2, successfully trade, 3, possibly have a social interaction that's meaningful, you know, marry your son, your daughter, sons and daughters, you know, together, like all these other items, the things that we establish kinship ties, whatever the case may be. Like, how do you participate in a world that makes sense? And how do you form a world that makes sense? And we do it every day, right? You walk into a store and the first thing you do, you don't typically like just go doing sprints in the store and laps, right? You have to act a certain way. Your behavioral practice, which other people have talked about for decades, is oriented around the space you're in. How does that work for people who are living in worlds where they're constantly moving, or not constantly, where they're moving in regular patterns, or whether their life is balanced between farming and herding, or whatever the case may be? And we can now say a little bit about that.
Yeah, it strikes me that the kinds of archaeological data that we actually have are catching up with the things that anthropologists have been talking about in terms of how people actually interact with one another over the past 50 or so years, where anthropologists have been aware for a very long time that human interactions are complex and messy, and that what we might think of as a defining feature of material culture might not actually mean anything to the people who are using those items. And conversely, they might think that something that we can't see at all is incredibly important to defining who they are. But now suddenly we're getting access to data that allows us to move past preconceptions of what defines identity and what defines who a person is, and actually get at kind of the meat and bones of interactions, like things that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I gave a paper not long ago amongst a number of archaeobotanists who are, you know, obviously I've been part of community, not as a botanist myself, but as some of my former students, and, you know, yielding that kind of data towards changing the way we understand the economy of some of these systems. But I kind of pushed back against sort of the full tilt kind of reliance on what people eat as somehow defining who they are. And this may be controversial, but, you know, so for decades, I wrote a book called Pastoralist Landscapes, right? Where it's like looking at the Bronze Age as essentially a pastoralist landscape through the lens of herding. And of course, that was before we knew that they had grains, right? So, you know, we didn't actually have the data yet. And it still holds to a large extent. We have to augment it now and say, okay, now they're also doing things with farming, and that's cool. But if I really were to rewrite everything right now, I probably would have entitled that book something like The Hunter's Dream or something. Because actually, all of these populations who spend a large proportion of their time keeping animals and a good proportion of their time growing crops, at least in the Inner-Asian Mountain Corridor, this sort of band of mountains going from basically Iran to the Altai, right? Like this territory that is connecting east to west and all these other things. That special space, if you look at the rock art and the ideological stuff, the artwork, it's all wild. It's all their vision of themselves is still as these like hunter-gatherers, or not gatherers, just hunters. Like, this is sort of the mentality behind their artwork. And I don't even necessarily think it's gendered. I mean, if you look at later Iron Age stuff, like tattooed individuals, you know, they're still covered in wild beasts and stuff. Like their ideology, I mean, think of Vikings. Vikings had this incredible ideology around mystical beasts and all sorts of other stuff and who they related to. Their day-to-day, they ate mush. I mean, they weren't, you know, savagely ripping meat off of the bones. I mean, maybe occasionally, but the majority of their food was like wheat and barley and mush, right? So their diet was keeping them alive and keeping their peasantry alive. Their ideology was, we are these incredible warriors, you know, inspired by dragons and who knows what else, right? So, I mean, this is a question now that I feel like, you know, you get to a certain point in science where you say, okay, we've been able to document through isotopes or through botany or through whatever the case may be, like, yeah, these folks are eating a wide variety of diets, choices. They're growing different kinds of crops. They're ecologically sort of, they're engineering their environments, all sorts of great stuff. Cool. But it doesn't make a damn bit of difference because they think of themselves in this way. And that's kind of still a leap for us. Like, we can't definitively say that, but I'm getting more and more cavalier about sort of taking those risks to say, actually, I think that we need to be thinking very differently about who these communities are, because who they become is significantly tied to them.
Yeah. Well, so you just had, you mentioned in an email that you just hosted David Wengrow. And I was thinking about this because I was reading through The Dawn of Everything. I'm writing a book right now, and one of the bits of it is on Göbekli Tepe, which they talk about a lot. And it strikes me that Göbekli Tepe, I think that people who went to Göbekli Tepe were at least part-time cultivators. But when they went to Göbekli Tepe, they were eating only wild grains. They were eating only wild game and a very specific subset of wild game. And it strikes me that, like, I think it's entirely possible that they were going there to kind of live out their idea of how they understood themselves or how they wanted to be, that even if their day-to-day lives were in kind of mundane villages where they're all living in their little rectangular houses and they're going out to till their fields, when they went to Göbekli Tepe and they built something huge and important, they got to go out and they got to hunt. They got to hunt their gazelle. They got to go hunt boar. They got to go catch some foxes. And that was like, they got to be as they wanted to understand themselves, you know? And
at very least, we have to recognize that, you know, the title of my talk in that local conference was, you know, we are not what we eat. Like, I mean, yeah. You know, in all cases, in some cases we are. And there are cases where, like, you know, food is highly like ritualized and cuisine is super culturally definitive, but it's just a different way of thinking about the step. The big picture here for me is that, you know, we're now at a point, and I'm, you know, this new book I'm writing, I started it actually 10 years ago, around 2016, I took a pause. Mm-hmm. And it was because of this DNA study in part. We launched the DNA study process in 2015. And I realized that if I were to finish the book at that time without having it out, that I was going to be selling myself short on the opportunity to say something really, really significant. We didn't actually publish that for another 5 years, basically 2019, right? So I kind of was on hold, just writing pieces of it, like filling in some, you know, things that I was learning. And in the meantime, the arc of that DNA study was coming to pass. So many other scientific things came out and so many other sites were discovered and other neat little pieces of the puzzle emerged that now I'm super grateful. And I told my editor recently, this is coming out with Cambridge University Press, and I told them just the other day, I was like, you know, I know I'm late on this book, but it's going to be way better. So stay tuned, like, because the ability to now say something much more novel, given the progress we've made in the last 10 years versus me just kind of slamming it out as kind of a summary book that would have been basically not that novel at the time, you know, 10 years ago, I'm actually quite happy with the delay. Albeit, it's got to get done. So that's kind of coming up now, and it's giving me the opportunity to kind of talk about some of these issues in ways that I think will be really fun, especially the idea of the difference between what we know scientifically about populations and what we might imagine or think about them in terms of their own emic vision of themselves, like who they see themselves as. Like, can we get to that? Can we talk about it? Can we risk to say something about that? Like, in a book, you can at least take that risk. So,
I mean, it's really interesting because I feel like 20, 25 years ago, a lot of archaeologists that we would now call like a postmodern tradition really wanted to talk about stuff like that, but didn't necessarily have hard data to back it up. So they wanted to talk about ritual and self-presentation. And a lot of that work, as kind of mind-blowing as it was and creative as it was not founded on a lot of actual hard stuff. I mean, like, so, like the really famous site of Star Car in Yorkshire, which is like, there are these incredible antler masks, and people wrote these really fantastic creative articles about the meaning of the antler masks and like blurring the lines between human and animal. And like, yeah, that, I mean, like, it was really cool work, but it was pretty speculative. But now with different tools, we can approach those questions in a much more rigorous way, it seems to me.
I mean, in some cases, I mean, you're still in the realm of speculating in a lot of ways. But the other thing too, that's, I think, come out of the scientific advances that we've made in the last 10 years is our ability to sort of, in some ways, not be overly convinced by ethnography. Yeah. And, you know, I've always been a fan of sort of more direct ethnographic relationships to say, okay, well, this population somehow has a historical tie to that population, so therefore it might be a slightly better proxy than something else. It turns out that ethnohistory in many ways can steer us away from what the truth is. Like, you know, when we started documenting grains amongst these pastoralist communities, which I still refer to as pastoralists, because I do think that a lot of their self, you know, their value systems and things are still tied up with animals. But, you know, we have to accept the fact that some of them were also growing crops and some of them weren't. And that's the other cool thing, right? We have neighboring populations now in the Interasian Mountain Corridor where they have 100% access to grains, where we don't have any grains on one site. And then the next site over, we have abundance of grains. And you're like, these are a kilometer away from one another. Like, it's not like we didn't know. But this group either isn't growing them, isn't eating them, or something is different. And who knows? Like, there's lots of interpretive potential there. But we can recognize that just because I'm a farmer doesn't mean that you're a farmer. And yet we both are pastoralists. And maybe I'm only a pastoralist of a certain kind. And maybe I'm a metallurgist and I don't bother my extra time with farming. I get it from you. So, you know, again, it opens the door to much more kind of complex sets of institutional relationships, which is really what kind of has driven my work, I'd say already now for a long time, is really trying to core into what are the practices that we have. You wake up in the morning, what are the things that you do? Mm-hmm. How does that shape the forms of participation that you have access to or that you know how to execute? And then how does that execution or that participation then reiterate a broader institutional framework? So anything from what you do when you go into a movie theater is the practices. You go in the movie theater, you get your popcorn and you sit down. The participation is that you don't talk a lot. You don't scream a lot. You're watching the movie. Everyone's following the same set of rules and institutions to say this is, but what you're actually building up is an institutional domain of this is how Americans in the 21st century were entertained until a pandemic when nobody did it anymore. And so, like, you know, that's kind of the levels of which you go from what you can actually document scientifically to what you can speculate institutionally about how a society is organized. And that's what's really, I think, for us, me and my team, right now, super occupying, because it's like we can begin to talk about, you know, we did this in an article about burials. It was like, what makes a good burial? And what do you need to give somebody so that they can have a happy afterlife? And it turns out that lots of people are doing a very similar set of things. And they're participating in the same sets of practices, either with knowledge of one another, or very least with the idea that there's this broader sort of, I would say, religious kind of sentiment about what makes a good afterlife. You know, religion is a dangerous word in archaeology, but I think it is one that we can use again. I mean, if you have vast numbers of populations across huge territories practicing similar kinds of behaviors and participating in similar kinds of rituals, can we make the assumption that they at least have some broad sense of institutional similarity? Maybe.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
I really like the way that you're talking about the economy in general, because it's very from the ground up. And one of the things that bothers me about scholarly work a lot of times is the abstraction of it. So when you're talking about economic modes, it's just people working, people digging holes, people harvesting foods, people slaughtering animals, people tending their animals. Like, that's all an economy is. And in the same sense, what we would call a kinship network or a network of social interactions or a religious tradition is just people doing things that they share in common with other people. And so what I really like about the way you're describing it is that you're taking it back down to the level of those interactions or actions, and then building the portrait up from those in the aggregate, instead of looking down from kind of the theoretical construct to try to explain the individual action.
Yeah, I think that's been, for me, like the most effective way to kind of wrap my head around whether or not some of these broader theoretical frameworks that we have, whether they're useful or not. So, you know, take the social evolutionary track, right, which is what Wengrow and them criticized. I totally agree with them. Like, we're looking at these expectations of, oh, if you have a major architectural center, then automatically it means X, Y, and Z. Well, that's an incredibly top-down approach, right? They would argue that, no, like, you can have a city, you can have a huge monument, you can have a pyramid. It doesn't always mean that there's some overlord or a ruler or a king sitting at the top of it. Like, there might be other mechanisms that build towards that. And again, just finding the case studies and opening your eyes to the idea that actions don't always lead to these archetypical kinds of end results, be it the state or, you know, a tribe or a chiefdom or whatever the category might be, is already, I think, you know, and this isn't something that we've been talking about for decades, but it's already sort of an innovation in the way we can use archaeology towards helping people understand how we are today, and especially while society is, in a sense, stepping away from those structures. I mean, if you think about the way so many of our interactions work today, they are dissociated from our urban centers. They're dissociated from where you live, whatever. Like, I mean, I honestly forgot exactly where you're, I guess you're on the West Coast. But, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter, right? We're just now we have these capacities to interact across time and space. And okay, that's driven by technology, but what if technology then allowed that? I mean, I'm really interested now, not in the migrations as sort of a broad population scale thing. I'm interested in the innovative ways in which individual people decided to pick up and move vast territories. Like, this is shocking to me. We have now really good evidence from prehistory. I can't get into too much of it because a lot of it's pre-published, but we have really good evidence now that suggests single individuals, and many of them, I mean, not just one case, like thousands and thousands and thousands in different points in prehistory, we can show single individuals who made enormously wide-scale treks. And you got to figure, like, how the hell were they managing that? Today, you can manage it because, you know, there's a certain degree of, like, population density, and you can get a map, and you can look up your features here and there. But the fact of the matter is that, like, in prehistory, 5,000 years ago, you know, you might have packed up a wagon or something like that and just wandered off. I mean, that seems unlikely to me. So that means that there has to have been some mental mapping, some preconditioned sense of what the world looked like. And we give no credit to prehistoric populations for having what we can consider to be global cartographies. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really interested in this question of, like, okay, if all these people are out there and they're all interacting and they're all doing things, how is this translating into a mental map of the world? Mm-hmm. Like, so they didn't draw those maps. They must have understood, oh, if we go east this far towards the sun, you're going to hit those people who wear those antler heads. And, you know, they think this. And so when you get there, make sure you have these things in your pocket so that they don't cut your head off. Like, you know, that kind of knowledge of participation is what I'm really trying to grapple with. And it's hard, but it's at the same time, like, a really cool concept.
Okay. Well, so I want to follow up on that. That's a fundamentally different model of migration, and migration as a subset of mobility more broadly. The kind of worldview that you're talking about with people who are capable of moving that far implies return journeys. It's not one way I move and I'm setting up shop in a new place and now we're established there. It's that you're setting up long distance connections between people and places that endure over time and which have an effect on both ends of that, right? So, like, in the case of, like, the Bactrian Margiana archaeological complex or the Oxus civilization, the relationship between that and the steppe is a two-way street. All of the evidence suggests that that's a two-way street, right? That there are people moving back and forth between those things at some scale. There are ideas, loan words, genes that are moving in both directions along that. That is not a bunch of people picked up, moved, and stayed there. Like, you're talking about the creation of a much different kind of relationship between people and places over space and time.
Yeah, and I think that we can now see that as it's associated with different kinds of practices too, right? So, like, you know, metallurgy, for example, is a really interesting one right now that we're working on, where the need for certain ores and the certain elements pushed people out to find contacts. I liken it to a mega version, or like a macro version of what you do when you're trying to find a craftsman to work in your house. You ask around and you say, okay, you know, I need to have some carpentry done. Do you know somebody? And everyone gives you the name of their person. Right? Okay, I know this person, I know that person. And those people come over, and through a process of trial and error, you decide on who your person is. And that inherently ties you to the other people who used that person in some kind of, like, distant and indirect network. And I don't disagree with the idea that for certain technologies, there were individuals who were communicating these kinds of things. Like, if you're making high-end bronze, or if you're making, even, you know, by the Iron Age, you know, iron and steel, et cetera, these are technologies that you just don't pick up on, you know, on a weekend. Like, you need to be taught. And yeah, there's people in each community who might be able to teach you a bit. But, you know, there are smiths. I spent some time three summers ago, 2018, or how many that was ago, four summers ago. Jeez. talking to a lot of blacksmiths in Uzbekistan, like doing some ethnography amongst blacksmiths. And they're incredibly knowledgeable about the other blacksmiths across the entirety of Central Asia. Like, this is not a small community. And if you're a blacksmith and you walk into a forgery, it's within minutes that those people know that you're one of them. I mean, you're all the physical and verbal and all the capacities, the way you pick up a hammer, all the things that you do illustrate specifically that you are trained in that field. And the level of like respect and access that you have all of a sudden is just catastrophic. I'm not a blacksmith, so I don't receive that. I get, you know, more of a tourist reception. But it's funny because my grandfather was a steel worker. He wasn't a blacksmith. He worked in a larger, you know, factory type setting, but he knew a ton about steel. And so as I was talking to this one blacksmith about producing steel, in this case, it was, you know, medieval high carbon steel, the kind of stuff that most people call Damascus steel. And we were talking about the forgery process and hammering and folding the metal and everything else. And I was telling him that my grandfather was a hammersmith. He basically worked in the steel factories that produced crucible steel, and they would hammer just like you do with a small hammer, but they would do it at industrial scales, right? Mm-hmm. And we started talking about the whole process. And he got so excited that there was like some tie to metallurgy that he like offered to show us. And he like fired up his bellows and like the whole kit and caboodle. He got like his whole team in there, and they started producing on the spot like high carbon Damascus steel for us to show like how you actually make this thing. So we're standing there in like leather, like suits, as like sparks are going everywhere. And it puts you in this like medieval moment where you're like, this is an incredibly complex process that you just don't pick up on a weekend. So when you feel that process, and this is where experimental archaeologists really, I think, enjoy that kind of moment. But you start to realize that these technologies going back 5,000-6,000 years were not just sort of flowing in this kind of, it's not like buying an iPhone and opening up the manual. Like these are technologies that you have to learn and have to master. So when you pick up one of these little like bronze axes or knives or whatever, there's some person or people behind that who have incredible amounts of skill. And that skill comes through direct communication with somebody else who has that skill. Mm-hmm. When you get down to that level, it puts a face and a fingerprint on pretty much all the materials that we handle. And the same could partially be said for pottery. Pottery is hard to do even in and of itself. So that's kind of the levels of like practice and the levels of like engagement that I'm trying to understand in terms of how it shapes this bigger world of people defining their cultures.
I mean, the idea that you might be able to get access to that 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years after the fact is intoxicating. I mean, it's crazy. Like, I mean, I also just love the idea that the I know a guy model of history is
like, yeah. I feel like that could be a title of a great book, right? The title is the book's entitled like I know a guy .. in prehistory. Right?
Yeah. Look, I'm a big fan of like type of guy analysis as a means of understanding the world. And so like the idea that just like the Bronze Age smith as a wandering character who's passing on his knowledge to all sorts of local smiths, that's like, I mean, but there are all sorts of parallels for that, right? Like that model, it makes sense in practical terms, but there are also tons of parallels where you see it in Bronze Age Europe, right? With the kind of the mythology of the figure of the smith, that there's this kind of mystical knowledge that goes along with that. And there's good evidence for the mobility of individual craftspeople. It makes sense. And again, if you want to abstract from those basic interactions, that's a network. That is a kind of a network that exists between communities that is not necessarily coterminous with what we would call like a speech community, with an ethnic community.
That's why I would call them non-uniform, right? So this whole non-uniform complexity model, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's basically a way of saying like not everything comes together in a big bundle, right? Like there are different vectors and different scale networks for different kinds of things. And that's what creates the complexity of the step. That's what allows us to see, you know, certain things spreading in some direction, certain things connecting in other directions. And it just doesn't move in this big migratory wave that we like to simplify things in. And while we were caught up still in our genetics article of like producing some big arrow maps, you know, it was somewhat unavoidable. But if you read the article, it actually kind of defies the big arrow map reconstruction, right? It's really about so many little moving parts and intricacies of those networks and diverse scales that, you know, I think for me, it's the, you know, the devil is in those details, and being able to extrapolate from those really, really small scale details to a big picture is always the challenge, right? And that's where, you know, for people who are listening to this who aren't archaeologists, it's a question of how do we make people care about those details in a way that doesn't just lose them in the jargon, right? Like, can you imagine a situation where this particular kind of technology sets off another set of things? And I'll give you an example. There's evidence for extremely wide-scale networks of ore exchange. Mm-hmm. And those ore exchanges span Eurasia at a scale that is truly astounding. And when we see those networks popping up amongst societies that we then recognize, we meaning the West, right, broadly defined, it's shocking. And that includes Egypt, North Africa. I mean, it's not just sort of Northern Europe either. It's just sort of like the broad sort of anything outside of China, basically, let's put it that way, mm-hmm. or the Middle East. The trajectory of metal production that happens at that time, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, in the Western arena, which includes North Africa, sets into motion something that is world-defining. Like, it's so hard to sort of summarize that in a term that just doesn't sound crazy. Like, when we start doing things with bronze, we learn how to alloy in a way that is just crazy. So bronze alloys give us the capacity to do things that we couldn't do with simple metals. Bronze alloys then give us the opportunity to start working with iron and iron alloys, i.e. steel. And steel, I mean, who, you know, this is where Jared Diamond starts, right? Guns, germs, and steel. Steel is still steel. I mean, I give him credit. Like, steel is still one of the most amazing pieces of technology. Of course, not a Bronze Age one, but one that comes out later. But nevertheless, like, every city, every structure, all of these things that we live in today, our entire world is predicated upon steel. Every time a plane takes off, every time a rocket launches, I mean, we are dependent upon the capacity for metallurgy. And yet, if you ask any kid on the street, like, what's the most important technology in the world? None of them will say steel. And none of them will recognize that steel alloys grow out of a technology that is bronze alloy. And that's it. Like, bronze is the first really major alloy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it makes intuitive sense on one level. The idea that, you know, demand for something in one place might create these enormous knock-on effects that span a continent. Because you have demand for tin in one place, that stimulates the development of tin mining and conflicts over tin mines, you know, half a continent away. That makes sense on the kind of a theoretical view. But to actually be able to document that 4,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, I mean, that's an incredible thing. And suddenly that makes the whole idea of a Bronze Age make more sense, right? It's not the metal itself. It's what does the metal do and what kinds of relationships does it spur? What kinds of connections between people and places does it create?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've always criticized to a certain extent, you know, these axial age terms, you know, Stone Age, Bronze Age, Copper Age, whatever. They're captivating and functional because there's something sort of like bizarrely inherently true about them, even though there's lots of caveats. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I mean, for that Bronze Age, like, meaning the period of time in which we really truly see like bronze as kind of this high technology, there are a couple other major technologies that come out. I mean, there's a couple other things that we start to see like, wow, this really does change things as well. But none of them seem to have that like long cast, that long game impact, that path dependency. Like, the examples that we can see in today's world, the you know, obviously plastics is an interesting reality for something, but it's ultimately wrapped up into petroculture, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's probably for a short period of time, at least the last, whatever, since coal started being burned, I suppose. Well, coal's been burned for a long time, but I mean, like, let's say the last 500 years or something, you know, where we start to see steam on the basis of coal and other kinds of things and petrol fuels, and then petrotechnology, meaning producing of polymers and things. That's probably your next big, like, breaks from metal. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I mean, everything's still built out of metal. You don't have skyscrapers built out of plastic. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, so it's like we are still relying on these very sort of core elements that are so ancient.
It's one of the things really fascinates me about it is like when a new technology shows up, you don't know what it's going to do. There's this tendency to view technology as either a driver of a social process or as a direct response to a need. And that's not what technologies are. I mean, like, you know, they're hunter-gatherers in East Asia who have pottery for 5,000 years before they ever think of settling down in permanent villages or, you know, before they start processing plant foods at scale. the fact that they have pottery, once they start doing those things, changes the path that they're on. It changes the way that they do those things, but it's not downstream of either of those. Like, they made pottery for reasons of belief, right? Like, you can never be sure where a technology is going to lead once it's developed or how it's going to slot into some greater need. I mean, bronze is a fascinating example of that.
And the other one, obviously, for the step is the horse. Horse isn't the same kind of technology, right? It's a domestication, but it is a technology in the sense that it does achieve certain capacities, right? And, you know, obviously the horse has gone through its own utilization history, right? I mean, you have just the basic things of people eating horses and that kind of thing. But then once we get to the point, you know, where we are pretty sure now that folks are breeding horses for particular mobility purposes, et cetera, I honestly feel that like the horse becomes another one of these really open-ended things where would you have imagined 4,000 years ago that by 500 BC that you'd have armies and cavalries and other kinds of things? I mean, the utilization of horses for so many other purposes becomes really innovative in a lot of ways. And that's why people are so hung up on the horse in a lot of ways. I mean, the poor sheep and goat don't ever get the credit they deserve, right? They're feeding everybody's bellies, but it's the horses that everybody wants to talk about. And, you know, there's a truth to that that's undeniable. I mean, I wrote a paper a long time ago that pissed some people off, but it was called Sheep, Goat, and a Few Horses. And it was basically like it was the actual numbers, you know, behind a lot of these steppe populations, like actually how many horses are amongst their sites. And it was like 80% sheep and goat, 20% cattle, and like 1% horse. And you had an odd horse here and there. But it was like the horse was everybody's focal point for decades, talking about why the steppe was so significant. And I've sparred with people like David Anthony over this for years, right? About like how important the horse really is. And now it's getting its whole new resurgence with other scholars. But a horse is too beautiful and too gregarious to ignore, right? So you have to be a real, like, I don't know, someone, I'm probably some little place reserved in hell for me because I'm not so fascinated by horses. But I guess at the same time, I can't deny that capacity for them to be really revolutionary technologies in the long run, right?
Yeah, I mean, try arguing with any 3-year-old girl about the importance of the horse, and you're gonna wind up on the losing end of that.
Oh, I've got two of them at home. Trust me.
Yeah, there's like try being the anti-horse guy in that context. It's not gonna work out great. I mean, I could ask you questions about this all day, but I have taken up so much of your time. This has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for chatting with me, and thank you for your work. I really appreciate it. I hope we get to chat again.
I hope so too. I enjoyed it very much.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.